Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV. Today we're talking with C-SPAN founder, guru, eminence, Brian Lamb. Brian, thanks for sitting down with us.
You bet, Nick.
Brian, in 2003, we named you one of our 35 Heroes of Freedom to celebrate our 35th anniversary, and I'll just catch up the viewers with what we wrote. Brian Lamb, the great stone face of C-SPAN, has produced more must-see TV than anyone else in the history of the medium. There's no reason to pick a favorite among the likes of Booknotes, Washington Journal, and all the other C-SPAN fare, but his greatest contribution may well be his first, turning a surveillance camera on the den of iniquity known as the U.S. House of Representatives.
I don't stand by that. Those are your words.
That's right. And I would put you in the list, which was alphabetical. You're on a page that includes the beat poet and junkie William Burroughs, the great baseball player Curt Flood, who broke the reserve clause, Larry Flint, Milton Friedman, Barry Goldwater, Friedrich Hayek.
Wow.
We are talking with you today partly about Supreme Court cameras. What have you been doing to get the C-SPAN cameras, the C-SPAN treatment into the Supreme Court?
Well, I could say quickly that we've been waiting and waiting and waiting. I mean, it's like every other institution of government. There's always a time when they decide, the individuals in those different branches of the government, when it's right for them. You can go back in history and look at the fact that the Senate was closed to everybody for the first 5 years. Everybody. You couldn't go watch a debate. The court's the last institution in the federal government to open the cameras, and I think we got a while before we're going to get there. We has, as an organization, recorded every single speech that any Supreme Court justice has given since we've been here in business that they'll let us cover. That's one way we've kind of gotten ready for it.
What is the great benefit of, you know, taking a kind of C-SPAN style transparency to the Supreme Court?
You know, it's really a very simple thing. It's a government institution that's funded by the American taxpayers. The individuals that work there all get paid for by the taxpayer. And the decisions aren't even reached in that courtroom. They're reached behind closed doors, which we're not asking to do. And it's a public discussion, a public, back and forth between the attorneys. Almost never lasts more than an hour. It only happens 75 to 80 times a year. It's not really that big a deal. And it just completes the picture that the public could have of the government that they pay money to.
Who are the people who are against it? I mean, are all of the Supreme Court justices against it, or are there differences of opinions
that
you know
about? We don't
really know. Really?
There's never been a public vote. I asked Justice Breyer once in an interview, have you ever talked about it in the court? And he said, I don't want to be sure I'm quoting it right, but basically, no, they hadn't, supposedly. I suspect they talk about it informally. I've only ever seen evidence of a vote once, and it came out, of all things, in an Irish magazine in which they were doing a special on William Brennan. And my memory serves me that he was the only one that had voted in favor of it out of the nine. It was an 8-1
vote. And at that point, he had no idea where he was?
I don't know what year it was. But
Some of the problems that people say, okay, you know, this will create a false sense of drama for oral arguments and whatnot, that the judges and the lawyers, et cetera, will play to the cameras. Is that a concern, or should that be a concern?
You know, it's certainly not a concern to me, but it is a concern to the different individual Supreme Court justices, and they make the decision.
Do you, recent changes in personnel coming up, Elena Kagan getting on the Supreme Court, we've had recent new people up there, does any of that matter in terms of this happening or not?
I'm only smiling because every time there's a confirmation hearing, that question is asked, what do you think of television? And they'll always kind of say, well, on the one hand, on the other hand, I haven't made up my mind. I'll wait till I get to the court. And when they get to the court, the first word you get out of the court is they've said it's not a good idea. But it's really a kind of a thing that happens among the nine. If the Chief Justice would start saying, I think we need to change, then's when the discussion begins.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense, and I guess this is just conjecture, but the judges don't, you know, and they are, you know, partly because they're hidden from plain view, they still have this kind of priestly mystery and power around them. I mean, are they afraid that this type of action really will demystify their power? I mean, it is like going behind the curtain in Oz or something.
I think there are a lot of things at work, and every individual justice is different. One of the things I think is working is that they have the most respected institution among the government institutions, and so they're just kind of saying, why change? You know, we're doing pretty well now. Why put these cameras in here? Also, you have individual justices that don't want the attention. There are some that legitimately feel, they think it's legitimate to feel that this will be a show rather than an exchange of views. It's so much different in the court today than it used to be. It used to be a passive institution. Now it's activist. You've got these justices going at that attorney standing there in the well. They can't even say good morning without, what did you mean by that? And would you further, you know, go into the process right then? They're on it just like that. It's a different place.
And do you think the Supreme Court is mostly worried that they're really going to start having to hit the gym if they're on camera?
I don't think.
Because if the camera adds another 10 pounds, some of these people are, we don't have a screen big enough.
Boy, I wouldn't go there on that one, except if you look at Justice Breyer, he couldn't get a whole lot thinner, or Justice Ginsburg for that. I mean, they're not heavy people, most of them.
You publish at C-SPAN the audio transcripts of oral arguments and whatnot. What's been the pattern in those podcasts?
Well, let's start with the over the years, audio was available of every argument since the 50s, I believe, 6 months after the last argument of any term. You could get our argument, and we did that. Every Saturday night, we put an hour on of the Supreme Court oral argument. Then back during the Rehnquist Court, we started asking for permission to get it same day. Actually, we'd love to have it live. Oh, no live. But we'll give it to you periodically right after the argument is conducted. And, for instance, Bush v. Gore we got right after that. And all the networks, I mean, we send a letter, and all the networks usually join us in the idea. It's just been up and down over the years. The current Chief Justice has basically said no for a long time. There was a time that he would say yes. There's no rhyme or reason to what arguments we get in. We think that this is so non-threatening that the Chief Justice would do well, but let us have it all. I mean, why? You're not taking any chance by letting us have the oral arguments on audio.
And is it true that the Terry Schiavo oral arguments perfectly sync up with The Wizard of Oz?
Let it be seen by your audience that my lack of response represents the way we at C-SPAN would answer a question like that.
Why aren't the transcripts good enough? If we have audio and if we have transcripts, why isn't that sufficient?
My quick answer to you would be, why then don't we just rely on print reporters to tell us what's going on at the White House or in the Congress? It's a new world, and audio and video I think they're here to stay. And I think we have the First Amendment protecting us just like everybody else, and there should not be a difference applied to these two different
meetings. Follow-up on that, is that ending? Michael Powell, the Bush administration's FCC commissioner, used to talk a lot about how you can't have two standards for news that's delivered via print and then broadcast signals or cable. You got to have one standard. First Amendment should apply to everything. He worried that, in fact, that the problem with pushing that argument is that the First Amendment protections historically accorded to print might go away and it might be more like broadcast. But do you see, is there a shift towards a universal application of the First Amendment, and is it going in what you would consider to be the right direction?
I don't see any real evidence that it's changing. There are always threats, and different political sides like to kick up their heels on that issue, the fairness doctrine and equal time and all that. It is interesting over the years how anybody ever thought that electronic media deserved a different standard than print media. The print medium. And the only and the absolute only reason that they ever got a foot in the door on applying a different standard was because the original television stations and radio stations were licensed by the government because of the shortage of spectrum. That pretty much has gone by the side, and you have things like XM Sirius Radio, podcasts, the internet, and it's but you have the thing you always have to keep in mind is you have regulators that sit over at the FCC couple thousand of them. They have things that, once you ever have an organization like that, you have to do things. And you have committees on Capitol Hill, and it's a good way to raise money, by the way. You throw a bill in to put a fairness doctrine in, all of a sudden you've got lots of people paying you money for your campaigns.
In a strange way, the scarcity argument now that you know, the government needs to be involved because there's a scarce resource is being applied more to newspapers, because every city in America has far more cable news outlets and TV broadcast outlets than they have newspapers. Do you think it's a good idea for the government to get into in any way, shape, or form, whether it's through helping nonprofits form, whether it's subsidizing the print media? Are these good ideas or bad ideas?
From my point of view, and I've been associated with an organization for 31 years that spent $1 billion totally from the business, not from government. There's not a dime's worth of tax money in here. As a matter of fact, if it ever got to that, I'd leave. I think the mixing of tax money and the media is very, a very bad idea. From where the money comes, comes the nudge, the power, the suggestion. It's bad enough when you pay for it yourself now, how much power they try to bring to you and suggest that you do things their way. It would be even far worse if the money from the taxpayer went into these media organizations. I don't think they have any role to play at all.
Do you ever get pressure from the cable industry? I mean, C-SPAN is created by the cable industry. It's funded by the cable industry. Do they, you know, what levers do they work on you?
None.
Yeah. And they now have, are you just saying that? Is that what they tell you to say?
Absolutely not. It's fascinating. Over the last 31 years, I will bet you that I have had three or four conversations with somebody in the cable industry that you ought to do this. And the hilarious thing was the first time it happened, I mentioned to my chairman, I said, you know, I'm getting a little gas from this guy that's on our board. And he said, well, let's just put an amendment to our Constitution in that says that no board member can have anything to say about programming. We just ended that.
You have never, in 1996, you Tom Hazlett, an economist who's now at George Mason University, interviewed you for Reason. One of the big issues then was concentration of ownership in the media. You know, is that a problem? Most people would say it's worse now than it's ever been. Do you find that to be a threat or a reality?
It's far better picture for the average person in this country than it's ever been. I personally don't like it when I see one company owning lots of things. I mean, that's just a personal thing. Whether you should legislate that or not is a very big question. I don't like the idea because it's funny, the cable industry, just one example, they used to say that you could only own 30%. Well, why not 29% or maybe 35%? Well, the courts threw all that out. You know, as long as you have the tremendous opportunities to express yourself like you do in this country via something called the internet, it's pretty hard to put the genie back in the bottle, and I think that's the best. That's the best thing about freedom of speech.
In '96, when we talked to you, there were various issues that are laughable or quaint now. You spent a lot of time talking about the V chip, which, strangely, is now in every new TV, and probably nobody even knows what it is. I mean, it was designed to use the ratings program so parents wouldn't have to care what their kids were watching at any given moment. What are the issues? What are the key issues for you today in terms of the media landscape and regulation of media?
Well, let me just say that it's still to this day, it's still, and this is not regulation, but it's still how much capacity is out there for your programming to be seen. In other words, C-SPAN is not universally, all three channels aren't universally shown on every platform because there's always, it seems like there's always some kind of a shortage out there of space. There's no shortage yet on the internet. But when it comes to regulation, the industry, and I don't speak ever for the cable industry, the industry always has issues because if you look at law as it is passed, it's always kind of a jury-rigged process. It's like 30% over here, and you can have X number of radio stations, and you can't do this and can't do that. So there's always going to be an issue. I mean, that's just the way that place is organized over there.
Do you worry about kind of, and these, there's always a constant hum of this, but then it peaks in every once in a while, going back to the fairness doctrine or applying a fairness doctrine to cable, which historically the content is not regulated, or the FCC saying, you know what, since cable is where all the action is, we should be regulating that now. Do you worry about that kind of stuff?
Well, I worry about anybody in government thinking they can regulate speech, regulate channels, regulate content. You can't keep track of it. People can't watch it all. There's so much out there today. Compared to when I talked to Tom Hazlett in Reason Magazine, it's unbelievable how much is out there. I can't even watch, even begin to watch what's on our own networks. I probably, if I'm lucky, see 10% of it.
So you haven't seen the C-SPAN porn channel?
It's kind of subliminal. It works behind C-SPAN 3. It just comes out, and you have to watch very closely when it comes through.
Do you worry about net neutrality issues, especially as C-SPAN, talk a little bit about how C-SPAN is migrating to the web, to the Internet, in a way that a decade ago it was a very different landscape.
Actually, a decade ago we were streaming. We were the first television network.
You were also streaming in that real audio, horrible format.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, it was impossible
to watch.
We were
streaming, networks, yes.
Talk about C-SPAN's early adoption of the Internet as a distribution device, and where you see things going now. What are the roadblocks to, really kind of that being the new frontier?
One of the interesting things about our industry-based board of directors is that they have always approved any migration to any other way to distribute us. And actually, it's been strange because they've been so supportive. We were allowed in the early days, 95 or so, to stream our video on the Internet free to the public. I mean, it really is one of those strange things. It's a true public service that they have never interfered with. We were allowed to sell our product before we had to sell it, forced by the government to sell to the satellites, which has always been very interesting to me. Talk about industry. Can you imagine if Reason Magazine was not allowed to have its content to itself and it had to sell it to somebody else? Or if you, for instance, had somebody writing for the magazine, you were forced to sell it to the Weekly Standard or Nation Magazine.
And that's because of what, retransmission rules or whatever, where you, as a cable content provider.
I am not a lawyer. I have no. It doesn't make any sense to me at all. I mean, I'm glad to have the revenue, believe me, because 33% of our revenues comes from the satellite. But our board allowed us to sell to the satellite before it was mandated by the government that we had to.
What do you worry about campaign finance laws and regulation of speech affecting something like C-SPAN? Because these are clear abridgments of the First Amendment, but often gussed up in the language of trying to make sure that political rhetoric is even-handed and is fair, et cetera.
I really don't worry about that. There's only one worry that I have about C-SPAN, and you got to understand, I'm speaking now from the, you know, being associated with this network, a place to work, it's a job, all that stuff. The only threat, really big threat to us, is the millions and millions of dollars that's not been documented by anybody being spent right now by the federal government or the taxpayer to do their own television about their own institution controlled by their own cameras. It's going on throughout the government, and no one's paying any attention to it. So one day we're all going to wake up, and everything that the government is doing, at least as viewed by government staff, is going to be on the web, and people might say, we don't need you anymore. Why would we need you? And as a matter of fact, that the big threat is that they will run the cameras themselves. They'll decide what shots they get. Journalism will be diminished even further by that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that's a serious threat to C-SPAN's type of transparency?
I have no idea. I'm 68, may not see it in my lifetime, I've seen things like that happen before.
You talked in the 96 Reason interview, you were really big on satellite radio. And at some point you said, like, boy, imagine driving in a car with a satellite radio. Has satellite radio paid off in your estimation?
Satellite radio has been fabulous. We have been allowed to put our product on XM. Sirius actually dropped us from their service, and now they're combined, which is interesting. They took the competition out of that, which competition is the best thing that could ever happen to anybody. It keeps you on your toes, and it also makes people a lot sharper in the product they put out. But we still are on XM, still go into probably 18, 20 million cars, and it's been fabulous. It means that we've been able to be heard from all over the United States, and so have a lot of other talk show people on the left, the right, and the center that would have never been heard otherwise.
Do you think, talking about the left, right, and center, do you think political discourse is particularly debased now or angry or vitriolic, or is it same old, same old? And is it in a good, are we in a good patch or a bad patch for this?
I think what's going on in talk is fabulous. The hard right, the hard left, I don't care what it is, it's stimulating a lot of people to think. Some people aren't thinking. They have a point of view. That's fine. They've always had that. But we act like this is all new. I mean, remember when they used to strap guns to their belts and go into the House of Representatives and challenge one another to a duel? This is pretty tame stuff.
Are you a technological determinist? On a certain level, your entire career and C-SPAN is based partly on technological innovations, whether it's the branching out of cable, finally, cheaper technology for cameras for transmission, the internet. Is it really are we really following technology and thinking that we're in control of it?
We are following technology, and every single time things get better, it's because some genius engineer invented a multiplex somewhere, and they get no credit whatsoever for it. It really, the talent you see, including yours truly, really would never exist without the technologists.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw a Philo Farnsworth stamp, and I was like, who the hell is that?
Who's and old it, Philo? Yeah, yes. Yeah. He had a role to play.
Yes, for sure. Who are your, let's talk a little bit about your political heroes. Who are your political heroes? Do you have political heroes?
No.
Why not?
Well, you know, we've taken the
mind.
Do
you actually not have them, or are you, you don't want to talk about
it? I don't have them.
Yeah.
People that watch
So filled with hate, anger.
People that watch us think we're up here thinking about we have an agenda. No agenda. My only agenda has ever been in politics. I mean, I've gone through different stages in my life where I thought I knew what I was talking about. But my only agenda is, how are you going to pay for this? I don't care what you spend it on. That's a decision that the process very carefully can make, or not so carefully. It's, where's the money coming from? It's the money is the biggest issue in the United States, and the debt and that whole issue, and that's going to be what kills us, not whether you're pro or pro-choice or pro-life. Those issues are for people other than us to decide, and it's really hard here because the government works so hard at making it hard for us to find the money. Where is it being spent? That's a game that's being played, sadly.
Talk a bit. I mean, you're one of the great prophets, and you've been honored in your hometown and your life and your lifetime of transparency. And I mean, this is not, you know, it's not a buzzword that a Republican or a Democratic politician uses, but just, you know, trying to make clear and obvious what's going on, how the machine is put together. Talk a little bit about your experience both in the Pentagon, war in Vietnam era, as well as your service in the Nixon White House or Nixon administration, and how this made you want to make transparent what government does.
Oh boy, there's a can of worms. When I was in the Navy, in the Pentagon as a 24-year-old, wide-eyed, I was learning everything for the first time. And I watched this thing that went on between the networks, and there were only three at the time, and the government, and the dance that was conducted, and in the middle of the Vietnam War. Fascinating thing is that the Vietnam War was as open as any war has ever been, but the government hated what the media did in the Vietnam War. The government usually hates what the media does in all wars. But just watching that process led me to think we need more openness in all this. This is not an intellectual thing for me. It's just that the tighter it gets, the more misinformation gets out. I'll never forget the fact that I was the guy for 2 years on the desk that the three networks would call to ask Robert McNamara to appear on Face the Nation. They called it at the time Issues and Answers on ABC and Meet the Press. And for the entire 2 years, he said no. The entire 7 years that he was there, he said no, until the day he resigned. And so all during that period, he avoided the questions, the tough, and they were a lot tougher questions in those days. You only had one guest on. They didn't have this mishmash that you get now on these Sunday programs. And one guest would come on for 30 minutes and answer questions, usually from journalists, and they would go after him. But Robert McNamara refused to talk to any of those shows. My early experience was this needs to be not transparent. I hate the word. It's open. It needs to be open. And I had the same experience when I went into the next administration. I think I was 29 years old. I worked for a guy named Tom Whitehead. His full name was Clay T. Whitehead, who was one of the best thinkers I've ever known. And he truly, in his gut and his heart, believed in openness. The Nixon administration didn't. Richard Nixon and the people that were immediately around him didn't care one thing about openness. That's the last thing they really wanted. They wanted to use the Fairness Doctrine. For instance, when Tom Whitehead proposed that you get rid of the Fairness Doctrine, they were really ticked off inside the crowd right around Richard Nixon because they wanted to use it as a weapon against the television networks to report things the way they want them reported. The more I saw up close of government and its interaction with the media, the more I felt that you needed to have no regulation, because the more levers they have of regulation, the more they will use to shut the media down, because politicians like to control speech.
Do you have a politics?
No.
Do you vote?
Yes.
Do you talk about who you vote for?
Never.
How come? Shouldn't that be part of the openness?
Yeah. If I were making editorial decisions every day here, and there was a way to really fool the public in what we do here, maybe. But, you know, I'm a private citizen. I don't have to tell you how I voted. If I gave my views, which I don't, maybe that would make a difference. But I've never thought a journalist really should have to give their views. By the way, I overall like the fact that somebody that is reporting and has strong views and is using the influence of that just soon they tell me what side they're on, I'll do a lot better with it and stop suspecting them.
If somebody sifted through, we got like a supercomputer and sift through all the programming of C-SPAN, and they wouldn't be able to draw a pattern, which is Brian Lamb's secret politics.
Gee, have at it.
Yeah.
That'd be fascinating. What a waste of money. It would be tremendous. I mean, everybody go, oh, wow. Now what do I do with it?
You're from Indiana. You know, Indiana, you think Dillinger. You think maybe Axl Rose, Brian Lamb.
Axl Rose is from my hometown.
Yeah, what? You played at his school prom?
No, but I did play the drums when I was in high school. I went to the same school he went to, and I went to school with his uncle.
Really?
Yeah.
Also talented?
Very. His name was Jerry Lintner. He was a very talented fellow. Yeah.
Was he called Axel or, you know, ball bearing or anything? Is it a family tradition? Or
He was just good old Jerry.
What imprint, for good or ill, has... it was West Lafayette or Lafayette, Indiana?
Oh, no, Lafayette.
Okay.
Purdue's in West Lafayette, where I went to school.
Yeah.
But it's like you draw a line.
Okay. So what imprint? And did you draw that in blood? Or in
No, but you know, if you went to
Lafayette... Not in restrictive covenants, I hope.
No. If you went to Lafayette Jefferson High School, the people on the west side at the West Side High School, they were called the River Rats because we had a river running through the town. I mean, it was strong.
So what? How did that inform? You talked a little bit about how your professional life informed your dedication to openness. What about your hometown? Does that inform how does that inform who you are and what you do?
I basically saw politics in a state that if you were... What is that, Nick?
Oh, that is...
Is that technology?
Yeah, it is, yeah. And I think that's a unauthorized ringtone to boot.
That was embarrassing. I was starting to wax eloquent.
Yeah,
my
I know
hometown.
That. And then it's like, sorry, I have to take this call. I'm like, you know, I'm like Paris Hilton during a sex tape. I never turn off my phone. But no,
I'm not
so,
here.
Yeah. talk about Lafayette then.
Well, as I was starting to say about Indiana and Lafayette, Indiana at the time used to have a rule that if you worked for state government, the party in power got 2% of your income.
But get out. Like, what is, I mean, Even the mafia doesn't do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, they don't do it anymore. Yeah. But I really got educated about politics from my father, who was a wholesale beer distributor, required a license from the state, would pay money to the Democrat running and the Republican running, and then get furious when the winner wouldn't do what he wanted him to do. And he needed a license, and he loved the fact that he knew the chairman of the Alcoholic Beverage Commission, and he was his personal friend. And it goes on and on. I saw it. I mean, he'd take him to football games with him. He was a friend of our families and all that stuff. And they worked when the governor was elected to get the person that they wanted in as the chairman of the Alcoholic Beverage Commission. It's, in a microcosm, exactly what we have all over the country. And I said to myself, you know, there's something wrong with this.
What's the solution, though? Because that, as you said, you see it in different ways all over the country. I mean, will you be able to get rid of that? And if you can, how do you do it? And if not, then what's the best way to live with it?
I do not have a solution other than somehow, some way, the incredible money thing has to be taken out of politics if you want to clean it up at all. You know, you're never going to clean it up. It's human beings. Power is a lovely thing to have, and people want it. They go after it. Once they get it, they want to keep it. They can't give it up. They go, you know, you have people that are in their 80s and 90s that can't leave the Senate and all that stuff. You can see how it affects you. And you begin to think if you're gone, the place is going to pot. I don't know the
answer.
You
know, at Reason, we're hoping it'll go to pot sooner rather.
That's true. And I realized when I said it that I walked right into your corner.
You're a big drug user, right? Big drug user?
Ooh.
Hard drugs mostly?
No.
Just the soft ones?
Just this. Okay. Never mind. I'm not. Meredith, that's off the record.
Yeah.
Shut that tape down. I didn't agree to anything here.
You didn't sign up for this.
I didn't sign up for this.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, I may well be out of questions here. I had something, and now I'm like wondering who called me. It's
Obviously, I am not doing very well in stimulating your thinking.
No, what do you think is the best political book or book about political philosophy that you've read? What's on your shelf of, you know, great political books?
I have tried to read over the years Democracy in America by Tocqueville. I've read some
Which means that you've failed. You've tried to read.
It's hard.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a lot of it I've read, and it's important.
Right.
Obviously, the Federalist Papers, some of that's got great insight to it. I've read so many books like this over the years. I'm trying to think of the book that matters. I mean, you can go from one end of the spectrum to the other. You can do Saul Alinsky's book and Friedrich Hayek's book. I think if you're going to be fair to yourself, you read them both. Mm-hmm. So you get an idea of how different parts of the spectrum think.
Do you have a softness for what is sometimes called the old right tradition, a kind of pre-World War II right wing, maybe Robert Taft, H.L. Mencken, a particular soft spot? This is just something when I watch when you appear on Book Notes or doing the various interview shows, oftentimes there are people, the books and the authors seem to be coming from that older kind of tradition. And
not really. I do the best I can to find people that I don't agree with or don't understand or have. I mean, we try here to get people who have different points of view out on the edge. You can't always do it. When people get in front of you, sometimes they don't, as you know, they don't talk very well or they don't.
I'm learning that lesson.
It's so right. They don't
right
give.
Yeah. You're a taker, aren't you?
I had to define Robert Taft to you right here, I'd fail. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was around when he was around, but I really don't know what I think. Maybe you can tell me what I think.
Are there any political figures that excite you particular, either as because of their philosophy or because of their celebrity?
No, I mean, I try not to. If you get terribly excited about any politician, then you begin to pull your punches on them. You just treat them all the same. I suspect if I were not here doing this job, I'd have people that would be attractive in the political system. I like to see speakers who can move audiences. And, you know, over the years, two of the best were Mario Cuomo and Newt Gingrich.
Mm-hmm.
But after you've done this as long as I have, you tend to watch people who fall in different categories, not of right or left, but how they go, how they approach an audience. What do they do, whether it's Reagan, Obama, or you go down the list of people, and what do they do to capture audience's attention? You could also go to Larry King and Oprah Winfrey. They move people for whatever reason, and there's no rhyme or reason to why they do.
How did you come up with the idea of asking? I think one of the great delights of you would have been great in East Germany as an interrogator. When you have an author on and you ask them, you know, here the acknowledgement, who is this person? How did that come about, that kind of technique?
In fairness to the question, I suspect it came about that we are definitely the antidote. At least I always felt that I was the antidote to what you saw on television. Not a celebrity, not emotionally involved, and because of that, almost exaggerated this, as you would say, stone face, so that you wouldn't give the people out there watching any indication of where you're coming from. Or it's taken to the extreme. It's not the way I am personally, where you don't really want to laugh or smile or indicate, wow, this, you're really terribly excited about sitting in front of this person. And so it's kind of gotten to be...
You become the gargoyle version of yourself.
Right.
I think that's what you're searching for.
You become the cartoon of yourself, yes.
So is your demeanor then, is that like the taking a kind of Midwestern reserve to the nth degree?
Yes.
You don't really believe that, do you?
No.
If you could put on a different mask right now, what would it be? Or if you could live your life over again? Obviously, you've really haven't delivered on your early promise.
I'm not anxious to live it over again. If I had to live over again, I'd be a drummer, full time on the road. Mm-hmm. It'd be.
What kind of music would you play, or will you, or do you also like? That's not important.
I would be the backup band for Merle Haggard or Willie Nelson, either one. And if I couldn't do that, I'd be the roadie with Brenda Lee.
Well, I think we will leave it on that note. I want to thank Brian Lamb of C-SPAN for taking time to talk to Reason TV today. I'm Nick Gillespie. Thank you, Brian.
And thank you, Nick.
Yeah.